Okay,
All right.
over to you, Francis.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the 63rd webinar on the Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on vaccara.us under the subheadings Moray Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the home page of moriafederation.com. Up here in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see the current webinars in progress. Okay, well, this will be our sixth webinar on the chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. We may finish next time with the seventh, may finish the chapter. We just have to see. We began our last session by taking a look at Max and Augusta Heindel's The Message of the Stars. It's re actually a really good book. Very esoteric look into the signs, the planets, etc. Here's a quote from the section on Sagittarius, which sign we are now in. Here is the man rising above the animal nature, bending the bow of aspiration and aiming at limitless space, signifying the loftiest longings of that immortal spark of incipient divinity we call the soul. This book also has a detailed and useful description of each planet in various aspects to the other planet. I found the, its commentary on the aspects to be insightful, accurate for, those who I know anyway. We then took a look at Thomas Inman's Ancient Faiths, which describes the origins of the Piscean Age. Note the fish atop Isis's head engraved on the cover. We then learned about Matsya, who took the form of a fish in order to save the world from a great deluge. Though MPH cites Matsya as an example of the Piscean Age, Matsya was actually a character in the story of the deluge that destroyed Atlantis and the establishment of the fifth root race by the seven rishis or Sapta Rishi. You can see them here, the white-haired ones and the dark-haired ones. We then learned that the word fish is an abbreviation of this old title, Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, and Cross. This is just one of the references that tie the Christ to the fish symbolism of Pisces. Other include Christ as a fisher of men and the eating of fish instead of meat on Fridays. We then moved to a study of Aquarius, symbolized by the man with a jug of water on his shoulder, who dispenses the waters of life, spoken of by both the apostles Mark and Luke. Next, we took a look at Aquarius's rulers, noting that in esoteric astrology, Uranus has replaced Saturn as the exoteric ruler. MPH then notes that, quote, there are two distinct systems of astrological philosophy. One of them, the Ptolemaic, is geocentric. The Earth is considered the center of the solar system around which the sun, moon, and planets revolve. He goes on to say the other system of astrological philosophy is called heliocentric. This posits the sun in the center of the solar system, where it naturally belongs, with the planets and their moons revolving about it. In heliocentric astrology, there are no houses, ascendants, midheaven, lunar nodes, or retrograde motion, since all these qualities depend on a geocentric perspective. Instead, heliocentric astrology depends primarily on planetary aspects. You see it over here on the right side. This is the same chart for Barack Obama, cast both for the geocentric and heliocentric points of view. So it's primarily about planetary aspect. For this reason, it's not really practical to use the heliocentric astrology to the exclusion of geocentric astrology, but according to its supporters, when combined with the info gleaned from a geocentric chart, heliocentric astrology provides insights unavailable in geocentric astrology alone. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. So, let's start off with this passage. Could we get a reader, please?
I'll start off. Probably the rarest form of Scorpio is that of an eagle. The arrangement of the stars of the constellation bears as much resemblance to a flying bird as to a scorpion. Scorpio, being the sign of occult initiation, the flying eagle, the king of birds, represents the highest and most spiritual type of Scorpio, in which it transcends the venomous instinct of the earth. As Scorpio and Taurus are opposite each other in the zodiac, their symbolism is often closely intermingled. Honorable E.M. Plunkett, in Ancient Calendars and Constellations, says the scorpion, the constellation Scorpio of the zodiac, opposed to Taurus, joins with Mithras in his attack upon the bull, and always the genii of the spring and autumn equinoxes are present in joyous and mournful latitudes. The Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, who knew the sun as a bull, called the zodiac a series of furrows through which the great celestial ox dragged the plow of the sun. Hence, the populace offered up sacrifice and led through the streets magnificent steers, bedecked with flowers and surrounded with priests, dancing girls of the temple, and musicians. Philosophic elect did not participate in these idolatrous ceremonial, but advocated them as most suitable for the types of mind composing the mass of population. These few possessed a far deeper understanding as the serpent Scorpio upon the foreheads, the uraeus or witness.
Thank you, BL. Okay, first, probably the rarest form of Scorpio is that of an eagle. The arrangement of the stars of the constellation bears as much resemblance to a flying bird as to a scorpion. Scorpio, being the sign of occult initiation, the flying eagle, the king of birds, represents the highest and most spiritual type of Scorpio, in which it transcends the venomous insect of the earth. So can we get a reader for this passage, please?
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Scorpio, the scorpion, is often transmuted with Aquila, the eagle, which rises at the same time with Scorpio. They are closely linked in symbolism. Scorpio is the monster of darkness who stings to death, and yet preserves and reproduces, symbolizing not only generation, but regeneration. As the latter, it is Aquila, the eagle, the bird of the sun, which has conquered the dark side of Scorpio. that adversary that can drag man down lower than the beast, but when transmuted is the equal of light, which can exalt above the gods.
Thank you. Next up, by the way, I just might say that, first of all, I invite you to comment and ask questions anytime during the webinar. It's always more interesting when there's a dialogue than just me droning along. I also say that there's a higher aspect of the ego, which is the phoenix, representing literal death and rebirth, rejuvenation. That's also part of the symbolism. Okay, next up. As Scorpio and Taurus are opposite each other in the zodiac, their symbolism is often closely intermingled. The Honorable E.M. Plunkett in Ancient Calendars and Constellations says the Scorpion, this constellation Scorpio, the zodiac opposed to Taurus, joins with Mithras in his attack upon the bull, and always the genii of the spring and autumn equinoxes are present in joyous and mournful attitudes. So here's Plunkett's Ancient Calendars and Constellations. The quote references the myth wherein Mithras slays the Taurian bull of spring. Exoterically, in order to bring fertility to the land, but esoterically, representing the avatar's victory over desire. We see the scorpion down here in the left corner of the sculpture. The sting of the scorpion, DK tells us, represents the pain of our desire body, eventually leading to a rejection of the lower forms. Next, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, who knew the sun as a bull, called the zodiac a series of furrows through which the great celestial ox dragged the plow of the sun. Excuse me. So, given the fact that these three ancient cultures, right, Egyptians, Assyrians, and Babylonians, were all agriculturally oriented, and that they associated the sun with the one and only solar bull, it's easy to see how they might describe the sun's movement as that of a bull dragging a plow through the furrows of the zodiac. All terrestrial life was seen as a reflection of that which had its origin in the heavens. Next. Hence, the populace offered up sacrifice and led through the streets magnificent steers bedecked with the flowers and surrounded with priests, dancing girls at the temple, and musicians. Excuse me. So in ancient Greece, animal sacrifices, particularly of steers, were common during religious festivals. These events often included processions where the animals were adorned with garlands and accompanied by priests, musicians, and sometimes dancers. In fact, when I was in India, the sacred, you know, all cows and bulls are considered sacred. And you would often see them wandering the streets bedecked in garlands of flowers. It's quite a beautiful sight, really. During the festivals dedicated to Amun or Osiris, sacrificial animals were adorned with garlands and led in processions. The rituals included specific methods for slaughtering animals, such as binding them and slitting their throats with the blood collected and offered to the gods. Okay, next. The philosophic elect did not participate in these idolatrous ceremonials, but advocated them as most suitable for the types of mind composing the mass of the population, in MPH's opinion. But this is just one possible interpretation. In both ancient and modern times, a person's understanding as to the meaning of a ritual varies according to one's spiritual education and place on the path of return. I think it entirely possible that the quote-unquote philosophic elect did participate in these rituals, but had an understanding of the symbolism that allowed for a different perspective than that of the general populace. And finally, these few possessed a far deeper understanding, as the serpent of Scorpio upon their foreheads, the uraeus, bore witness. Well, actually, only the pharaoh and certain goddesses bore the uraeus on their forehead, which represents the solar dragon of wisdom and not the scorpionic hydra. It's the higher serpent, not the serpent that has to be overcome, that represents material desires. Any thoughts or questions so far?
Yes. Ariane, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you? Thank you. Thoughts, at least. You know, when we're going deeper into something like anything, the most simple thing, like in a procession or a vase of flowers, or better yet, a flower in the ground, you know, we see the grandeur in the most simple things. And I would agree with you, Francis, about that the way one experiences something is really dependent on the level of being that a person has. But I wanted to go back and talk about the eagle. You know, it's the symbol of many nations in the world, you know, the U.S., Russia, Nazi Germany. Also, it's a symbol, the scorpionic symbol for the Mayans. You see like a bird arising out of a serpent tail. So it seems like many nations understood the potential, and yet it's related to this lower idea of the Scorpio, which is part of each individual's spiritual challenge, in that as we evolve, there needs to be a goal not to bite other people, not to sting, not only with our words, but our thoughts, and even eventually with our emotions, that we don't permit any expression of, that doesn't mean that we're not critical or discerning, but it would be the lower scorpionic nature. And we can see that, for instance, the U.S., which is very much about projecting our fears and aggression onto other nations, that and then biting and attacking, pillaging, those kind of things, because our unbridled desires are not met, our cost or standard of living, whatever that we think is an entitled thing of ours, that when that's transmuted, the soul of the U.S. could emerge, that the eagle, which is really a symbol of the soul, I think, in all these nations that we're aspiring to, not only as individuals, but as a soul. And when the soul of America comes to take precedence over the personality of this nation, then we will be a true democracy and have a different kind of beneficent effect on other nations. And so some of us are literally waiting for that. It's not just a symbol or an idea. We don't know if it will happen our lifetime, but we're working towards that in a practical way. What does that mean? Not only on the individual level, not to express negativity and to submit to something higher, to make our life an offering, you know, but also what does it mean in the life of a nation? That's it.
Sorry, I was muted. So first of all, the idea of the eagle as connected with Scorpio has a lot to do with the concept of lifting the hydra out of the swamp into the air, which is the abode of the eagle. So on an abstract level, the eagle represents, you know, Buddhic consciousness, that place that where the personality entrains itself to the soul, you know, it occultly dies, right? Because it finds nothing in that higher environment that can sustain it. So that's the esoteric meaning behind, you know, both the eagle and the phoenix, you know, which rises into the air. And of course, the phoenix has the element of fire, which is purificatory, very much connected with Scorpio. And you had some great comments about the nations and the U.S. and, you know, right now, instead of seeing it, expressing the eagle in terms of the, you could say, higher mind and the higher possibilities that the eagle represents, that there is a kind of a prey-oriented association with the eagle. I think it was Benjamin Franklin that was totally against choosing the eagle. He wanted to choose the turkey for the national emblem because he felt it was much more humble. And he gave a whole list of reasons of why the turkey was ultimately a more noble creature than the eagle. But, you know, careful what you choose for your symbol, because you're likely to live up to it, right? Thank you for that, Ariane. Anyone else? Okay, next up, let's see, where am I here? Oh yeah. Yeah, we did this. Right, oh yeah, I just want to show this. When I was saying that only the Pharaoh and certain of the goddesses ever had this uraeus shown atop their foreheads. It's representing this direct connection with the gods. Okay, yeah, so we're next up. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
The sun is often symbolized with its rays in the form of a shaggy mane. Concerning the Masonic significance of Leo, Robert Hewitt Brown, 32 degrees, has written, "On the 21st of June, when the sun arrives at the summer solstice, the constellation Leo, being but 30 degrees in advance of the sun, appears to be leading the way, and to aid by his powerful paw in lifting the sun up to the summit of the zodiacal arch, three stars. This visible connection between the constellation Leo and the return of the sun to his place of power and glory at the summit of the royal arch of heaven was the principal reason why that constellation was held in such high esteem and reverence by the ancients. The astrologers distinguished Leo as the sole house of the sun and taught that the world was created when the sun was in that sign. The lion was adored in the east and the west by the Egyptians and the Mexicans. The chief druid of Britain was styled a lion. That's from Stellar Theology and Masonic Astronomy. When the Aquarian Age is thoroughly established, the sun will be in Leo, as will be noted from the explanation previously given in this chapter regarding the distinction between geocentric and heliocentric astrology. Then indeed will the secret religions of the world include once more the raising to initiation by the grip of the lion's paw. In brackets, Lazarus will come forth.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, first up, the sun is often symbolized with its rays in the form of a shaggy mane. So the sun's corona can be seen as a shaggy mane, but it's the sun's triple rulership of Leo that most associates the lion's mane with the sun. TK says, in Aquarius, the initiate consummates all that has been achieved in Leo through the influence of the sun. For in Leo, there is an almost unique condition where humanity is concerned, as the sun governs all expressions, exoteric, esoteric, and hierarchical. It rules the personality, the soul, and the fourth creative hierarchy. Next. Concerning the Masonic significance of Leo, Robert Hewitt Brown, 32 degree Mason, has written, on the 21st of June, when the sun arrives at the summer solstice, the constellation Leo, being but 30 degrees in advance of the sun, appears to be leading the way and to aid by his powerful paw in lifting the sun up to the summit of the zodiacal arch. The quote, summit of the zodiacal arch is the summer's solstice. Here's Brown's Stellar Theology, source of the above quote, full of cool illustrations like this one. One of the most prominent Masonic symbols is the five-pointed blazing star, often associated with Sirius, whose festival is celebrated in Leo, the fifth sign, five-pointed star, fifth sign, right? There's also a Masonic grip called the lion's paw, which symbolizes resurrection during Masonry's third degree. This grip symbolically lifts the candidate from darkness to light, and thus into the realm of solar consciousness, hence its association with the lion and the sun. In the labors of Hercules, the dominant physical sun is personified by the Nemean lion, which represents the fully integrated personality that must be subdued by the aspirant disciple. This is one of the main tasks of the Leo disciple. The I am must become the I am that. The Nemean lion must become the Lion of Judah. Next. This visible connection between the constellations Leo and the return of the sun to his place of power and glory at the summit of the Royal Arch of Heaven was the principal reason why that constellation was held in such high esteem and reverence by the ancients. Well, actually, in the year just over 1000 BC, in that age, Leo was the solar, the summer solstice was in Leo. So that would have been the principal reason why the constellation was held in such high esteem. Can we get a reader for this passage, please? This is from, this is a question and answer from the book we were just looking at.
Okay, Ariana, I'm going to ask you to please read that for us in just a minute here, but let me read your comment here. She says, among shamans, the eagle or hawk is not only experienced as all seen, but is loving, bestowing higher consciousness and protective.
Yeah, nice comment. Yeah, it's a symbol. Wings in general and is a symbol of the second principle. You know, we move from astral to Buddhic consciousness in our passage, and that's what the bird life in general symbolizes. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, the thunderbird over the heart. So yes, I just can't say it enough. I hope everyone here experiences it personally. It will change your life. So this says, question, why are there three great zodiacal points which support the royal arch of heaven, also emblematic of wisdom, strength, and beauty? Answer. At the time of the building of King Solomon's temple, or about 1004 BC, the celestial equator cut the ecliptic at about 10 degrees of the constellation Aries. At that period, the constellation Leo was therefore near the solstitial point and summit of the zodiacal arch. Now, as the lion is the strongest of beasts, and because the summit or key of an arch is its strongest point, and the sun, when he reaches that point, has the greatest glory and power, it being the summer solstice, when the day is the longest, that point is emblematic of strength.
Thank you, Ariane. Next, the astrologers distinguished Leo as the soul house of the sun and taught that the world was created when the sun was in that sign. So here's the chart derived by the ancients that is considered to be the birth chart of the world, in which all the planetary rulers of the signs, including the sun in Leo, where is it? Here. Were believed to be ruled by the sun, were believed to be at the 15th degree of their respective signs. Leo is the only sign ruled by the sun, though the sun is exalted in Aries, the dominant fire sign. Interestingly, DK tells us that it was during a Leo cycle and had to happen during a Leo cycle that the fourth kingdom came into being some 21 million years ago when individualization happened. That had to be connected with that Leo constellational energy. And that could also be interpreted as the creation of the world. Just a moment. Okay. All right. Next, the lion was adored in the East and the West by the Egyptians and the Mexicans. The chief druid of Britain was styled the lion. And that's again from Stellar Theology. So in ancient Egypt, we see the lion in both the Sphinx and the lion-headed goddess Sekhmet, both described here by Joseph Campbell. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. In the early mythologies of the moon bull, the sun was always conceived as a warlike, blazing, destructive deity. And in the fierce heat of the tropics, it is indeed a terrible force, well likened to a lioness or to a pouncing bird of prey. Whereas the moon, dispenser of the night dews by which the world of vegetation is refreshed, represents the principle of life, the principle of birth and death that is life. Symbolically, the moon bull, like all living things, dies and is reborn. And whereas on the one hand, its death is a function of its own nature, on the other hand, it is brought about by the pounce of the lioness or of the solar bird of prey. So that the solar bird or lioness actually is only an agent of a principle of death that inheres already in the nature of life itself. Hence, the sun must be conceived to be a manifestation of only one aspect of the life-death principle, which is more fully symbolized in the moon. In the moon bull attacked by the lion, Sekhmet is a manifestation, therefore, of one aspect of Hathor, and whereas Ptah, in his creative phallic aspect, sends his moonbeam to fertilize a cow, the animal of Hathor, and thus generates the moon bull. In his punitive, death-dealing pharaonic aspect, pharaonic aspect, his consort is Sekhmet. His son by Sekhmet is the ruling pharaoh, symbolized in the human-headed, lion-bodied sphinx. Among the pyramids wherein the Osiris bodies of the pharaoh silently reside, from the Masks of God, verse 2, page 91.
Thank you, Martha. So the idea here is that the two are essential to each other. It's the fundamental duality of life and death. And in this, these, you know, Mediterranean cultures where the sun was so fierce, then the lion and the eagle were seen as representing that relentless quality of the sun, and that was ascribed to Leo, just as Taurus and a cow was ascribed to the watery aspect into the spring equinox. Okay.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry. Ariane wants to know, 21 million years ago, was that when the Sphinx was actually created?
No. No. No, it's, we don't know when the Sphinx was, when they, well, the Sphinx of the pyramids, you know, there's a lot of speculation about when both of those were created. Edgar Cayce puts the pyramids at 10,600 years ago. The Sphinx has a lot of obvious sea salt deposits in it, which modern archaeologists can't fit into their scheme of when the Sphinx was built. And but if indeed it was, if it was in existence during the last ice age, that would be one reason that you would have those deposits, putting it also at a great antiquity, but not that level of antiquity, because you're now talking about geologic periods when you're talking about 21 million years ago, and really nothing from that ancient time survives. Also, there was no humanity as yet with enough monastic development to build such a monument. Okay. Finally, we have, when the Aquarian Age is thoroughly established, the sun will be in Leo, as will be noted for the explanation previously given in this chapter regarding the distinction between geocentric and heliocentric astrology. Then indeed, will the secret religions of the world include once more the raising to initiation by the grip of the lion's paw. Lazarus will come forth. So again, we have MPH's peculiar understanding of the sun being in the opposite sign of what it actually is in, though it must be said that the theme of self-identity, which characterizes both Leo and Aquarius, will come to the fore during the Aquarian age. In other words, Leo will be prominent during the time of the Aquarian age, and it's always the case. The two signs on an axis are have a theme which, and they are interactive in the representing and the bringing forth of the that theme that they represent. In the case of Leo and Aquarius, it's this theme of identity. In Leo, it's individual identity, which eventually gives way to group identity, which is highlighted in Aquarius. And MPH is certainly right about, quote, the secret religions of the world, including once more the raising to initiation. For DK tells us that when the new world religion comes into being during the Aquarian age, the first initiation will be a public event. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please? Magda?
Do you hear me?
Yes, now.
In the new world order, spirituality will supersede theology. Living experience will take the place of theological acceptances. The spiritual realities will emerge with increasing clarity, and the form aspect will recede into the background. Dynamic, expressive truth will be the keynote of the new world religion. The living Christ will assume his rightful place in human consciousness and see the fruition of his plans, sacrifice, and service. But the hold of the ecclesiastical orders will weaken and disappear. Only those will remain as guides and leaders of the human spirit who speak from living experience and who know no creedal barriers. They will recognize the onward march of revelation and the new emerging truths. These truths will be founded on the ancient realities, but will be adapted to modern need and will manifest progressively the revelation of the divine nature and quality. God is now known as intelligence and love, that the past has given us. He must be known as will and purpose, and that the future will reveal.
Amen. So mote it be, right? Sooner rather than later. Thank you, Magda. Okay, before turning the page in this big folio edition, which we're following, let's take a look at the illustration at the center of page 55, which depicts the circular zodiac of Dendera. Here's the fold-out map of that zodiac, but we'll use this image since it is easier to make out the figures as we read along. So we'll just start with a general reading of this, and then we'll go through it. Reader, please.
Well, I was going to call on Jo, but I don't see her here. So let's go with Nadel, please.
The oldest circular zodiac known is the one found at Tentira in Egypt and now in the possession of the French government. Mr. John Cole describes this remarkable zodiac as follows, quote, "The diameter of the medallion in which the constellations are sculptured is 4 feet 9 inches. It's 4 feet 9 inches French measure. It is surrounded by another circle of much larger circumference containing hieroglyphics characters. This second circle is enclosed in a square whose sides are 7 feet 9 inches long. The asterisms constituting the zodiacal constellations mixed with others are represented in a spiral. The extremities of this spiral after one revolution are Leo and Cancer. Leo is no doubt at the head. It appears to be trampling on a serpent and its tail to be held by a woman. Immediately after the lion comes the Virgin holding an ear of corn. Further on, we perceive two scales of a balance above which, in a metal lion, is the figure Harpocrates. Then follows the scorpion and Sagittarius, to whom the Egyptians gave wings and two faces. After Sagittarius are successively placed Capricornus, Aquarius, Pisces, the ram, the bull, and the twins. This zodiacal procession is, as we have already observed, terminated by Cancer, the crab, close quote.
Thank you, Nidal. I just saw a major error here. It's not, oops. What happened? Yeah. It's not a metal lion, it's a medallion. So I'll fix that, a medallion. Okay, so I was thinking, a metal lion, what? And metal is spelled wrong. No, it's a medallion, above which in a medallion is the figure of Harpocrates. Okay, so first, the oldest circular zodiac known is the one found at Tintira. It's also called, in fact, more commonly called Dendera in Egypt, and now in the possession of the French government. So obviously this doesn't mean that this is the first zodiac ever carved or painted, but rather that it is the oldest surviving dated depiction. The zodiac now resides in the Louvre. It's a really cool spot because you can crawl in underneath it and lie on your back and look up at it. It's really neat. At least it used to be that way. I'm hoping it still is. The next passage describes the size of the Dendera zodiac, which is just under 8 feet square. So let's continue. The asterisms constituting the zodiacal constellations mixed with others are represented in a spiral. The extremities of the spiral, after one revolution, are Leo and Cancer. Okay, first, asterisms just means groups of stars. So it took me a while to figure it out, but here's the spiral of the 12 zodiacal constellations, beginning with Leo, bottom right, the outermost point of the spiral, which is the first sign after the summer solstice, then gradually moving inward and clockwise to Virgo. So here we have Virgo. Oh, here's Leo. And then Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius. And remember, as we're going through these, that these are the oldest known depictions of these symbols for the signs. Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces, Aries, the only sign outside the path of the spiral, then Taurus, Gemini, and finally Cancer at the innermost point of the spiral, directly above Leo, the initiating point of the spiral. So I looked far and wide to find the best images I could for these zodiacs, because they really represent the first depictions, and you can see some were just not so great, very difficult to find. Others, like this one, were pretty good. Okay.
Francis?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Vivian wants to know, in the sentence that talks about this, it gives the dimensions in feet and inches, and it says in French measure.
I don't know why they said that. You know, how that's very bizarre. Oh, I can't go back there. It's that, I think, 7 foot, 6 inches in French measure. So maybe what he means is that he's translating it from the metric system. That would be my guess, because there's no, as far as I know, there's no feet and inches that is particular. There's no version of feet and inches that is particular to French measure. I think he just must have meant it was translated from the metric system. Okay. Yeah, Nadal.
Can you go back to the larger blow up of this particular picture?
Well, this
back
is,
one, I think.
Sure. Absolutely.
No, not that.
Okay.
Yeah, there. No.
Okay. Yeah.
If I'm looking at this correctly, it looks as though this is going clockwise around the zodiac.
Right.
But yet the symbol, but aren't the various constellations going the other way?
They're odd because here, you know, for instance, Aquarius is upside down, but yes, traveling counterclockwise. Isn't that interesting? Let's see if that's, it seems to be true across the board. You can't really tell with Cancer, but certainly as we go, you can't tell much about Pisces. Let's see here with Capricorn.
But like if you were going from Aries to Taurus to Gemini, that would be the counterclockwise under sort of DK, wouldn't it be sort of the reversed wheel?
Right. That would be the path of, you know, the initiate, one who's reversed himself on the wheel in Libra, moves counterclockwise through the zodiac as the signs themselves move. So, you know, we may be given a kind of indication of both directions by the fact that the spiral itself is obviously, I mean, look at the way this snake that Leo stands on here literally seems to be the leading edge of this spiral, you know, that then just makes its way around. You know, it's not distinct except for right there. But whereas, as you mentioned, the figures, at least those figures that show a direction, you know, you can't really see much of a direction in Pisces or Capricorn or Cancer, but the others, or Libra. Well, no, even Libra has that. Harpocrates is facing this counterclockwise direction. That's a really good observation. Thanks for that. Yeah.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry. I want to tell you that Sam said that the French measure referred to the system of measurement that was used in France before the adoption of the metric system in the late 18th century.
And did that use feet and inches, and were they different than our current feet and inches? That's the question.
I can say that. I can answer that, Francis. They did have what's called the pounds, pied, toys, and lu. And this I know because I'm a bit interested in archaeology. I've read of a couple of them. It's like pounds is a French inch.
Okay.
And this inch is roughly equivalent to, I think it is about 27 millimeters. And then pied is a French foot, and it is equal to something like 324 millimeters or 12.8 inches. And toise is a unit of length, often larger. It's about 6.4 feet. This is what I know. I just wanted to let you know that all this existed a long time back before they had the metric system. And
right.
It is called the old royal units. If somebody can Google, they will get it. It's called the old royal units.
Yeah, I remember reading an argument about all that was lost through the abandoning of that royal unit, because there evidently was a number of sacred sites around the world that, when measured according to those old units, came out with a very interesting numerological correspondences that were lost you know, when the system went metric. So that's very interesting. The question remains, you know, in terms of this ceiling, which is correct, you know, we could probably Google and find out the measurements of the ceiling to see if it is indeed, you know, those feet and inches in accordance with the old French way, or if it's modern, you know, feet and inches. But that's,
I think it'll be slightly larger than what they said, because in old terminology, it is slightly larger than the metric system.
Well, it, you know, that's my memory. And in terms of laying under it and looking up at it, I thought it was bigger than 7 foot 6 inches in length at that outer square edge. My memory was that it was bigger than that, but it's been many, many years, so I can't say for certain. But thanks for that. Interesting.
Francis?
Yeah.
Maria says, from Google, 1 foot, French measure, or parent's foot, equals 12.789 inches, according to Canadian Weights and Measures Act of 1985, assuming 25.4 millimeters per inch. Also in France, the metric system is used for weights and measures, and 4 foot nine is 1,448 millimeters. And then Vivian says, John Mitchell referred to this in his geomantic work.
Oh, okay, yeah. John Mitchell is a noted sacred geometrist, so appreciate that. Great, thanks for the feedback. That's why it takes a village, right? It's that's real good. I missed that that phrase altogether when I was interpreting it, that phrase about the French feet. Okay, now we gotta get back to, okay, so here's what this temple looks like outside. It's an incredible temple. One of the most, maybe the most intact of all the Egyptian temples. Like, you know, a lot of them are just open air, they're ruins, but this one has held its the integrity of its roof, and it just is an incredible thing to visit. Okay, let me catch up here. I think, all right. Okay, here we go. So Leo is no doubt at the head. It appears to be trampling on a serpent, and its tail to be held by a woman. So you could see the woman holding the lion's tail here at left. This might be a reference to Virgo Leo as a combined sign, right? Because we're taught that at one time there were 11 signs, and the sign, the combined sign was Virgo Leo, which, you know, it's usually associated with the Sphinx, which has a lion's body and a woman's head. Sekhmet, interestingly, has a lion's head and a woman's body. Both may refer to that combination of signs. And so you might have something like that also here. Again, to Nadel's point, this would even have more of an indication of direction, because if Virgo is holding on to the lion's tail, now that would be a clockwise direction. Is that correct? Oh, now I'm all mixed up. Seems to me it would be, because that would put Virgo moving into Leo. So, yeah, but there's certainly an association established between these two signs. The holding the tail might also suggest sole control of the personality, a kind of variation on the eighth arcanum of the Bodha Tarot, which shows us this type of control. If the lion is trampling the serpent, it would be the serpent Apophis, which represented the lower appetites in ancient Egypt. But it looks to me more like the lion is striding or riding on the serpent, suggesting alignment with and guidance through solar wisdom, right? The same wisdom that guided the pharaohs through the Uraeus. The shape of the serpent might also be a subtle hint as to the existence of the spiral with the serpent's head. You can see here, here's the serpent's head, representing the spiral's leading point. So you can see here, it just continues right into this spiral that goes around. Who knows? Next, immediately after the lion comes the Virgin, holding an ear of corn. Further on, we perceive two scales of a balance, above which in a medallion, not metal lion, is the figure of Harpocrates. I'll leave it, fix it later. Here's Isis holding the ear of corn, which represented fertility, abundance, and the nurturing aspects of the earth. And here's the Libran scales, whose balance point is represented by Harpocrates. You can see him up here, the Egyptian precursor to Heracles. This is in keeping with images depicting Harpocrates mastering the pairs of opposites, as in this stele, which shows him standing on two crocodiles and holding two pairs of snakes. Next, then follows the scorpion and Sagittarius, to whom the Egyptian gave wings and two faces. So here's the Sagittarian rider on what looks like a winged horse. I couldn't find a very good image from the Zodiac of Dendera, but this bas-relief from the Temple of Hathor has the same motif. In this image, the second backward-looking face is that of a lion, suggesting a Sag-Leo combination, maybe, or possibly the backward-facing lion represents personality control. Okay, any thoughts or questions? Okay, next, after Sagittarius are successively placed Capricornus, Aquarius, Pisces, the ram, the bull, and the twins. This zodiacal procession is, as we have already observed, terminated by Cancer, the crab. So MPH describes the remaining signs without comment. And that finishes up MPH's commentary on the Zodiac of Dendera, which is found in the middle of page 55 here. Any final thoughts or questions on this? I was very happy to be taken to task and actually figure this out, at least to the degree that I did. Of course, that's just one small part of the entire Zodiac. You know, there's many other elements that still remain unexplored.
Magda has her hand up.
Go ahead.
Yes, we can notice that in this aurum section, we can read this image in a centripetal force, meaning from outside toward inside, toward the center, or which would be the profane direction. And we can read it in a centripetal initiate way, meaning from center to outside. But then we can read this also in other two ways, in a centrifugal force, which is from the inside to the outside, in the initiate direction and in the profane direction.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then you can put all the signs with all the characteristics that you know put together with this scheme. And also the Dendera zodiac is very interesting for the numbers, because the numbers key are 12, 8, 24, and 72, because 12 are the beings outside of the center, then 8 are the directions, 24 are the arms, 72 are the celestial bodies. Oh. So this is the how it structures the number-wise, how it structures our celestial logos of our galaxy. So this precise numeric structure has been found first in this Zendera zodiac. So this is very important one, which is in France, yes.
Thank you, Magda. Some good observations there, yeah. Okay, anyone else? All right. Okay, so that finishes up this little central illustration. Hang on a sec. All right. Next, we turn to page 56 up here. In the folio edition. Can we get a reader for this, please?
Sam, can you read that for us, please?
Yeah, sure. The antiquity of the zodiac is much in dispute to contend that it originated but a mere few thousand years before Christian era is a colossal mistake on the part of those who have sought to compile data concerning its origin. The zodiac necessarily must be ancient enough to go backward to that period when its signs and symbols coincided exactly with the positions of the constellations, whose various creatures in their natural functions exemplified the outstanding features of the sun's activity during each of the 12 months. One author, after many years of deep study on the subject, believed man's concept of zodiac to be at least 5 million years old. In all probability, it is one of the many things for which the modern world is indebted to Atlantean or the Lemurian civilizations. About 10,000 years before Christian era, there was a period of many ages when knowledge of every kind was suppressed, tablets destroyed, monuments torn down, every vestige of available material concerning previous civilizations completely obliterated. Only a few copper knives, some arrowheads and crude carvings on the wall of the caves bear mute witness to those civilizations which preceded this age of destruction. Here and there, a few gigantic structures have remained, which, like the strange monoliths on Easter Island, are evidence of lost art and sciences and lost races.
Thank you.
Come in. Grand letter, it's all right.
Okay. First, the antiquity of the zodiac is much in dispute. To contend that it originated but a mere few thousand years before the Christian era is a colossal mistake on the part of those who have sought to compile data concerning its origin. Historically, the oldest, you know, meaning artifacts, the oldest known reference to the concepts of the zodiac come from the Babylonian Venus tablet of Amisaduqa from 1700 BC to 70 Sumerian tablets on astrology called Enuma Anu Enlil, and three the 15th century BC Vedanga Jyotisha, one of the earliest known Indian texts on astrology. Of course, we know from the Ageless Wisdom teachings that these sources are just the surviving copies of much earlier sources brought from Atlantis by the progenitors of the Aryan root race. You know, also, the fact that, for instance, there are 70 tablets on astrology, that doesn't mean that astrology was invented as a result on these tablets or through these tablets. It just happens to be an artifact that has survived. Same thing with this Jyotisha Vedic system of astrology, which we know goes back thousands and thousands of years. It just so happens that the paper that it was written on, that the oldest one we've been able to date is, again, about, you know, 1500 BC. Okay, next. The zodiac necessarily must be ancient enough to go backward to that period when its signs and symbols coincided exactly with the positions of the constellations whose various creatures and their natural functions exemplified the outstanding features of the sun's activity during each of the 12 months. So two ideas here. First, the quote, period when its signs and symbols coincided exactly with the positions of the constellations, references the various ages, such as the Aryan, Taurian, and Piscean ages. Second, quote, whose various creatures in their natural functions exemplified the outstanding features of the sun's activity, references the idea that the creatures and symbols of the zodiac were chosen because they exemplified the prominent features of the sun's activity during each zodiacal sign. For example, the sheaf of wheat held by Isis represents the harvest, which took place in the sign of Virgo. Next, one author, and you know, actually I have more to say on this whole idea. The Aries on the spring equinox is the origin of the zodiac. In other words, that's how it is intended to be placed, right? But that doesn't mean that it originated, you know, in the Aryan age, which is, you know, 1500 BC. It's just was the a time when the zodiac, you could say, came around to that place where its archetype was once again represented. Okay. All right, next up. One author, after many years of deep study on the subject, believed man's concept of the zodiac to be at least 5 million years old. In all probability, it is one of the many things for which the modern world is indebted to the Atlantean or the Lemurian civilizations. Yeah, it'd be nice to know the identity of the author that MPH here cites as one author. At any rate, 5 million years ago takes us back to the middle of the Atlantean root race. My understanding is that astrology, which in truth is as old as the Earth scheme, was reintroduced by the hierarchy when humanity had developed the monastic principle enough to understand it, to make use of it. And it's been developing ever since. I would put that definitely in the Lemurian age, where it was initially introduced because they were, you know, initiates then incarnated both in Lemuria and Atlantis that introduced these ageless wisdom concepts to the inhabitants of those civilizations.
Francis.
Yeah.
Sorry. Arion says, during Atlantean epoch, the masters walked the earth, helping men, until the minority abused their power and intellect, until there was the Great War 98,000 years ago when Atlantis was destroyed. The masters are only returning now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We actually did about five webinar sessions on Atlantis where all of this was covered. So you could go to YouTube or to
Makara.
Makara, thanks. I blanked it. To makara.us and, you know, take a look at these sessions if you're interested. We got into it pretty deep. It's been a while. Okay, anyone else? Okay, about 10,000 years before the Christian era, there was a period of many ages when knowledge of every kind was suppressed, tablets destroyed, monuments torn down, and every vestige of available material concerning previous civilizations completely obliterated. Only a few copper knives, some arrowheads, and crude carvings on the walls of caves bear mute witness of those civilizations which preceded the age of destruction. Well, actually, there is no archaeological evidence to support the idea that there was a deliberate widespread destruction and suppression, but in a way there didn't need to be, because according to Edgar Cayce, whose views are supported in Plato's Timaeus, a deluge which destroyed the last remnants of Atlantis did happen about 10,500 years ago. And there was, as Ariane mentioned, earlier deluges that took out earlier subraces of Atlantis and of Lemuria. And finally, here and there, a few gigantic structures have remained, which, like the strange monoliths on Easter Island, are evidence of lost arts and sciences and lost races. So let's take a look at this excerpt from the second volume of the Sacred Doctrine on the monolithic statues of Easter Island. Can we get a reader, please?
Okay, but hold on just one minute. Vivian says, it may be interesting to look up the Bosnia Pyramid of the Sun, discovered by Sam Osmanagic. Well, she says if spelled correctly, and I probably butchered it. But anyway, the Bosnia Pyramid of the Sun might be interesting, is what Vivian is saying.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've looked at pictures, and that would be an example of, you know, one of these really ancient artifacts. Okay, thank you.
Marguerite, can you read for us, please?
Sure. The Easter Island relics are the most astounding and eloquent memorials of the primeval giants. They are as grand as they are mysterious, and one has but to examine the heads of the colossal statues that have remained unbroken on that island, recognize in them at a glance the features of the type and character attributed to the fourth race giants. They seem of one cast, though different in features, that of a distinctly sensual type, such as the Atlanteans, the Daityas, and Atalanteans are represented to have in the esoteric Hindu books. Compare these with the faces of some other colossal statues in Central Asia. Those near Birmingham, for instance, the portrait statues tradition tells us are Buddhas belonging to previous Manvantaras, of those Buddhas and heroes who are mentioned in the Buddhist and Hindu works as men of fabulous size, the good and holy brothers of their wicked co-uterine brothers, generally as Ravana, the giant king of Lanka, was the brother of Kumbhakarna, all descendants of the gods, the rishis, and thus like quote, Titan and his enormous brood, end quote, all ordered heaven's firstborn. These Buddhas, though often spoiled by the symbolical representation of the great pendant ears, show a suggestive difference perceived at a glance between the expression of their faces and that of the Easter Isle statues. They may be of one race, but the former are, quoted, the sons of gods. The latter, the brood of mighty sorcerers. All these are reincarnations, however, and apart from unavoidable exaggerations in popular fantasy and tradition, they are historical characters.
Thank you, Marguerite. Any thoughts or Francis, questions?
Yeah. Yes, we have several. Ariane says, so is it true that huge statues of the pharaohs are much older, with these statues of Ramses, etc., are much older, with Ramses merely carving his own name, like graffiti, on these colossal statues?
It's one theory. You know, their stone is difficult to date unless there's sea residue or wood fragments embedded in the stone somehow. Archaeologists believe that all of these come from, you know, no earlier than say 3,000-4,000 BC, which where they placed the first dynasty, whereas theosophists and alternate thinkers place all of these at much earlier, in much earlier stages. So, you know, that idea that these could be early statues that Ramses simply, you know, signed is evocative. But there's also indications of similar statues where they're you could say, more permanently part of the hieroglyphs connected with the statues. So, you know, there's an open question about this. None of the Egyptian stuff, though, is as old as what's just shown here on Easter Island. This is considered to be a relic of the Lemurian times, you know, not even Atlantean, but like one of the few surviving relics of Lemuria, because, it's said that Easter Island wasn't covered by the deluge that destroyed Atlantis. So, any other thoughts?
Magda says also, inside the three dimension, the circle of the zodiac, there is time, space, movement, death. Outside, there is none of it. It symbolizes the way Egyptians represented the numeric structure of everything.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Next up, could we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The human race is exceedingly old. Modern science count its age in tens of thousands of years, occultism in tens of millions. There is an old saying that Mother Earth has shaken many civilizations from her back, and it is not beyond reason that the principle of astrology and astronomy were evolved millions of years before the first white man appeared. The occults of the ancient world had the most remarkable understanding of the principle of evolution. They recognized all life as being in various stages of becoming. They believed that grains of sand were in the process of becoming human, in consciousness but not necessarily in form, that human creatures were in the process of becoming planets, that planets were in the process of becoming solar systems, and that solar systems were in the process of becoming cosmic chains, and so on ad infinitum. One of the stages between the solar system and the cosmic chain was called the zodiac. Therefore, they taught that at a certain time a solar system breaks up into a zodiac. The house of the zodiac becomes the thrones for 12 celestial hierarchies, or as certain of the ancient states, 10 divine orders. Pythagoras taught that 10, or the unit of the decimal system, was the most perfected of all numbers, and he symbolized the number 10 by the lesser tetractys, an arrangement of 10 dots in the form of an upright triangle.
Thank you, Anne Veronica.
Thank you.
First, the human race is exceedingly old. Modern science counts its age in tens of thousands of years, occultism in tens of millions. There's an old saying that Mother Earth has shaken many civilizations from her back. And it is not beyond reason that the principle of astrology and astronomy were evolved millions of years before the first white man appeared. So the Master DK places individualization at 21,600,000 plus years ago, which is when the solar angels overshadowed animal man and thus ushered him into the fourth kingdom in nature, the first truly human kingdom. But that's just on this globe. The fact that a number of disciples, including the Buddha, were initiated on the moon chain, in and of itself, extends humanity's existence back to inconceivably distant time. Next. The occultists of the ancient world had a most remarkable understanding of the principle of evolution. They recognized all life as being in various stages of becoming. They believed that grains of sand were in the process of becoming human in consciousness, but not necessarily in form. That human creatures were in the process of becoming planets. That planets were in the process of becoming solar systems, and that solar systems were in the process of becoming cosmic chains, and so on ad infinitum. So the discipline most aligned with the evolutionary process here described by MPH is theosophy. But the ancient Hindus, Buddhists, Gnostics, and Neoplatonists all believed in some form of evolutionary path made possible through incarnation, reincarnation, though these disciplines vary significantly in the details of this process. But TK teaches very definitely that a version of what's said here, not in the exact precise language, but a version of what's said here. Any thoughts? Okay. Next up. The occultists. No, that's what I just read. Okay, next. One of the stages between the solar system and the cosmic chain was called the zodiac. Therefore, they taught that at a certain time, a solar system breaks up into a zodiac. This is oddly worded and not strictly accurate. DK tells us that our solar system is a chakra in a cosmic logos made up of seven solar systems, and that this sevenfold unit forms a center in, or part of a center in, the one about whom not may be said. So this gives us a template to determine the higher path of becoming for solar logoi. The zodiac, on the other hand, is made up of a particular group of 12 constellations that sequentially come into prominence during Earth's journey around the sun. Some of these 12 have a number of prominent stars, others not so much, but all include a group of lesser stars. It seems to me that there would be a number of intermediate steps between the consciousness of a single solar logos and that of the lord of a zodiacal constellation. And that's gonna do it for today. Could we get some dates for coming events?
No, that's secret.
Okay. Sorry,
All
guys.
right. Okay. Let me see. What do we have? The next thing on your agenda is TCF on Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th.
And then the secret doctrine on Sunday the 15th. And then the next secret teaching of all ages is going to be on, whatever January is. Oh, the 5th of January.
That's it.
That's it, yeah.
And also in there is the pre-full moon. I think it's on the 14th, isn't it, of December?
Yes, I believe so.
Right.
Tuya is sending out the announcements for that, and it should be on the December calendar.
So we've been able to nicely avoid the holidays, in terms of like having webinars on Christmas Eve or something. So, okay, thank you all. Look forward to next time with you, which will be Treatise on Cosmic Fire on Friday the 13th. See you then.
Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.